here. Paul, I knew of your reputation as an administrator for many years and a musician, and those were both confirmed during the two summers I was privileged to work here with you, students, faculty, Northern Illinois University. And Ray Ching told me about your early support for this symposium. Another helpful individual to me was Janet Hathaway, currently in the School of Music. And of course, kudos also to Ray Ching for this initiative and for carrying it to fruition. But especially, finally, special congratulations to our distinguished symposium honorees. It is an honor to participate in your symposium. Dr. Hahn, since I met you last night, congratulations. Unlike the other two keynote speakers, I am not a world music specialist. That and the fact that I am privileged to speak first led me to decide to generalize, to attempt to place world music in some kind of context, and to speculate about an important potential role for it. That is, world music participation and pedagogy as a means for bringing together some of the disparate groups in our world today to harmonize them, if you will. It appears that musical practices have been universal throughout the history of mankind. Most likely, all human cultures have practiced music, just as all humans have spoken languages. Based on the apparent evolution of brain structure and other circumstantial evidence, it is reasonable to conclude that music could well have predated language. Along the way, music was probably displaced by language as the primary communication mechanism, and at that point, music shifted to secondary communication roles. Be that as it may, humans are hardwired for both music and language, and what emerges in each culture is at least one spoken language and at least one performed type of music. This seems to happen regardless of whether or to what extent different cultures learn from each other. Anthropologists tell us that there have been many thousands of cultures and many thousands of languages, and undoubtedly there have been many thousands of types of music as well. In the Western Hemisphere alone, a relatively late comer in terms of regions of human habitation, estimates for the total number of languages over time runs as high as 1,000. There must have been a great many types of music as well. Today, only a few hundred languages survive in the Western Hemisphere, and many of those are being kept alive, at least partially, through artificial means. In other words, languages appear to have become less diverse over time, and that is likely true for music as well. However, in modern times, music seems to be moving in the direction of more diversity, or at least certain musics are being disseminated more widely, which results in more people having more access to more types of music than ever before. Of course, world music is part of all this. In the long run, becoming more diverse may end up being fortuitous for music in general and for world music in particular. Working against this diversity in types of music in modern times is the domination, some say encroachment, of Western, largely American-based popular music. The same is said about the English language. Now, if all this is true, then why is it that musics, unlike languages, may be becoming more diverse? One reason is the inherently abstract nature of music. Another is the explosion in availability of technological delivery systems over the past century and a quarter. Related to availability is the increasingly wide range of roles music plays in society today, arguably more roles than during the pre-electronic age. Undoubtedly, people today have far more exposure to music than at any time in history, and the extent of that exposure continues to increase. This is true despite concerns about the alleged lack of participation in music today. Music is now such an important part of the larger environment, from shopping to television and film to sports to homes to bopping down the street, that it is probably safe to predict that music will become even more pervasive in our society in the future. I will stick my neck out if predicted will become more diverse as well. For the same reasons, other commodities become more diverse and numerous over time. In other words, it is likely that diversity in musics will increase, while diversity in languages, which function less like a consumable than music, will continue to decrease. I want to focus today on a specific subset of diversity in our world, racial and ethnic diversity, something I do know a little about, and something we can probably agree is an important aspect of world music. The variables of race and ethnicity can be, and often are, used as proxies for other variables related to diversity. So much so that what we may say about racial and ethnic issues related to world music could be said about several other characteristics as well. Among other things, I will argue that while world music reflects some of our human diversity, and like all musics, it could be used to divide people, it can also help bring us together. That is, it can bring harmony to our world and to us, our flawed but diverse inhabitants. So let's back up and talk about where all this human diversity came from. The best thinking today is that human species evolved first in Africa, starting about 200,000 years ago, and over the next 100,000 years, groups immigrated from that continent. Some ended up in what we call the Middle East, Europe, and eventually the east coast of Asia, and so forth. By the time those parts of the world became populated enough, some of these groups by then had been separated from other groups for many thousands of years, had developed what came to be known as racial characteristics. Of course, these physiological differences among groups were and remain biologically superficial, as evidenced by the fact that humans and all racial groups can reproduce with humans in any and all other groups. And today, we have additional evidence of the superficiality of alleged racial differences in the form of a molecule called DNA. In addition to physiological differences, all manner of psychological and social differences between groups also evolved during those long periods of separation, differences that align more with what today we call ethnic characteristics. And of course, some of the racial and ethnic characteristics overlapped. All these differences notwithstanding, we were and remain of one species, albeit with racial and ethnic subgroups that evolved during the thousands of years of separation. Most educated people today understand all this, including the serious doubts entertained about the legitimacy of race as a construct. But it bears repeating because we humans are exceedingly slow learners where racial and ethnic issues are concerned. We'll return to this theme of slow learning. In our quest for harmony among all this diversity and perceived diversity, it is important to take into account the substantial recent anthropological evidence that human history was far more violent than researchers believed even a generation ago. We are a tribal species, and it appears that human tribes have always competed with each other for food and other resources. Much of that competition involved violence. In or near most surviving prehistoric human habitation sites that have been studied by anthropologists lie piles of stones that anthropologists believe were gathered for throwing at enemies. And it appears that wolves may have been domesticated as dogs because they bark to alert their owners to the presence of intruders. According to one recent estimate, 25% of prehistoric adult males died of wounds inflicted by other humans. Since that estimate is based on evidence of skeletal wounds only, and since undoubtedly some fatal wounds did not affect skeletons, the death rate from warfare and other violence must have been higher than that. Such rates of violent death are unheard of in modern times. By some estimates, the largest modern war, World War II, resulted in the death of up to 10% of the populations of some of the most affected countries, and an estimated 2.6% of the world's population at the time. Anthropologists, historians, and evolutionary biologists also make it clear that humanity has improved immeasurably, not only in reduced tribal warfare, but in most ways over time. For primitive tribes, violence and other non-cooperative behavior may have been adapted to their environment, and therefore necessary. But over time, it is becoming increasingly maladaptive. In modern times, most individuals and groups experience more success when they cooperate more and fight less, both within and among groups. Today, we tend to think of human progress mainly in the realms of medicine and technology, but we have improved as a species in virtually every area, the critical realm of cooperation being one of the most notable and likely one of the most important. There is a widespread assumption today that invading aliens from outer space would either enslave or destroy us, the human inhabitants of this earth. This belief is understandable given the history of human group encounters. But some evolutionary biologists believe that any civilization advanced enough to reach Earth or outer space would be so evolved that invaders would not want to dominate or destroy us Earthlings, but instead would seek to cooperate with us. Given that the nearest star of the solar system is 10.5 light years away, that's 100 trillion kilometers, this is probably a safe bet. Regardless, the idea that evolved civilizations fight less and cooperate more is also based on our history here on Earth. In this case, the evolutionary improvements in relationships among and within groups throughout history. The spread of self-governance in the form of democracies and partial democracies since the late 18th century is a notable manifestation of cooperative behavior, even given the shortcomings endemic to those political systems. Today, with the world's population increasing at a rate and total number well beyond anything in the past so far as we know, and given the destructive power of weapons in the nuclear age, we really don't have viable choices about whether to cooperate or fight. Nevertheless, the news media and even historians tend to concentrate on conflict because it is more interesting than cooperative behavior. Despite all the negativity of hand-wringing over our problems today, there is less warfare and more trade and other types of sharing among groups than ever before. And there are better social conditions, including less crime, within and among groups as well. We have seen enormous population increases, but also enormous improvements in cooperative behavior, even within our own lifetimes. Apparently, we have learned that cooperation is adapting to the world in which we live. This is important because so far we lack alternatives, places to live. We can't very well just decide to vacate our earthly neighborhood. In terms of race relations, the United States is a nation that was founded on the Enlightenment principle of equality. But its original constitution legalized slavery and denied the right to vote to those slaves, to all women, and even most non-slave males. In recent times, much has been made of the fact that the country elected and re-elected a mixed-race president who identifies as a member of the African-American minority. And this truly is an extraordinary achievement of which Americans can take justifiable pride. I don't know of an instance in history of a major country electing a member of a formerly despised, repressed minority to such a high office. President Obama's historic first election took place in November of 2008, some 145 years after President Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, but only 42 years after my high school admitted its first African-American students. I grew up on a cotton farm near Memphis, Tennessee, and I well remember not only the racially segregated schools, but also segregated restaurants, hotels, churches, swimming pools, restrooms, funeral homes, water fountains, park benches, even partitioned cemeteries. The racial integration of my high school began during my senior year, 1966-1967. when two seniors from the town's black high school enrolled in our white school for their final year in graduation. The next school year, the Regional Army National Guard Battalion deployed to Memphis in the aftermath of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., a unit I later trained and served with for subsequent domestic issues. What remained of legal segregation in the United States crumbled during those years. After college, I taught at a school in South Mississippi in its second year of full integration. We have come a long, long way in a relatively short period of time. On the other hand, however much the situation has improved, racial prejudice is still pervasive in the U.S. and many other parts of the world. Today, 21st century, we still tend to stick together in our respective tribes as in birds of a feather flock together. Anthropologists tell us that such tribalism was adaptive behavior in a primitive world when tribes competed with each other for resources. But in our densely packed, complex modern world, such discrimination of sameness and otherness has become counterproductive or maladaptive. As a civilization, we're trying to absorb and apply these lessons. But throughout most of our known history, progress has been at best agonizingly slow. However, the pace has picked up in recent decades, so much so that despite the brevity of our individual lives relative to evolutionary history, the fact that all of us have personally witnessed progress on so many human relationship fronts demonstrates the increasing pace of our collective understanding. That's the good news, and I see the world music phenomenon as an emerging and potentially integral part of this increasing positive interaction and collaboration among groups, racial, ethnic, and otherwise. Indeed, that world music is already bringing us together is evidenced by the fact that so many of us traveled so far to participate in this symposium, which is being hosted by a respected academic institution. But questions still remain, such as why aren't we humans in a better place in terms of cooperative, non-discriminatory behavior? And how can we close the gap between where we are and where we aspire to be? Some of the answers to these questions are emerging from clues provided by evolutionary biologists, clues that point to reasons for our resistance to more thorough acceptance and assimilation of different types of people. Edward O. Wilson, one of the world's most renowned biologists, explains that humans are one of only 20 species, including certain types of insects, that are eusocial organizations, defined as those that cooperatively rear their young across multiple generations. There are these 20 eusocial species are hugely successful among the 8.7 million species that inhabit the Earth. The success is measured in terms of collective body weight in the case of insects and dominance of the planet in the case of humans. Now, Wilson believes that the evolution of humans as a eusocial species required social exchanges that expanded with the shift to a meat-eating diet among our humanoid ancestors about 2 million years ago. This, in turn, resulted in the evolution of a huge brain to store the knowledge necessary for survival, much of it involving cooperation. It also explains the strong urge to be part of a clan or tribe. This means that humans evolved to become adept at identifying members of their own clan as opposed to members of other clans. During that period, this ability and strong urge to identify with and cooperate within groups was adaptive. Researchers believe that while the propensity to distinguish or discriminate between members of one's own tribe and members of other tribes is so fundamental to our social and psychological structures, that for practical purposes, it is innate. In other words, racial prejudice is rooted in the tools people use to quickly classify people, objects, even ideas, into categories of good or bad. And these characterizations, discriminations, if you will, happen automatically. Such rapid characterization is adaptive, such as when we learn to assume that all mushrooms are poisonous and all lions want to eat us. Now, so far, so good, but the troublesome part comes when we draw on what is likely a hardwired cognitive essentialist style to make those judgments. The cognitive essentialist style rests on two problematic assumptions. First, that everything in a given category shares common essential qualities. And second, that these qualities are unchanging, immutable, and therefore essential. Essentialism is problematic for a racist concern because the idea of fundamental differences has been roundly debunked by scientists. Even people who have some sense of the problems associated with essentialism categorize race, gender, age, and other self-identification characteristics in the same ways, usually instantaneous and beyond the realm of consciousness. So it isn't a matter of whether a given individual or group discriminates or categorizes. In the words of one scholar, the capacity to discern us from them is fundamental to the human brain. Instead, what matters is how strongly these beliefs are held and how long, and what we do in response to them. Again, this tendency is reinforced by the strong need to identify with a group, in part because there is safety in numbers. These tendencies operate even when the criteria for group membership are arbitrary. But when the criteria are based on relatively obvious characteristics, problems often arise and persist, to say the least. Today, there are two major downsides to this identification behavior. One is racism, which is a way to distinguish between tribes. Another major downside is religious bigotry, which stems from the need to adhere to collective beliefs held by the tribe and to reject individuals who do not hold similar beliefs. And of course, it is in the realm of beliefs, religious and otherwise, that ethnicity comes in, because much of what can be said about race can also be said about religion and ethnicity in the way they relate to tribal identification. Finally, although evolutionary scientists focused on antiquity, in the modern era, it is clear that nationalism, as a mechanism and expression of tribal identity, overlaps a great deal with race, religion, and perhaps especially with ethnicity. We have seen innumerable negative consequences of racial and religious bigotry in the form of tribal rivalry throughout history. And of course, we have experienced manifold negative consequences of excessive nationalism since nation-states evolved. We humans have retained our highly developed and propensity to discriminate group membership into our modern age, despite it being potentially maladaptive. And this constitutes a serious flaw in the modern human species. We can mitigate these tendencies in ourselves and in society, but we cannot make them disappear completely. And therein lies our flawed nature. Again, though, this flaw could be fortuitous to music in general, and to world music in particular, because both can and do bring harmony to groups based on differences of various kinds. So long as we can use music and musical activities to help bring people together and to mitigate against our inherent flaws, we should be in business for the foreseeable future. Today, in the most democratic countries, social structure based on race is no longer codified by law, and it's typically illegal. However, traditions and unwritten rules, exacerbated by our fundamental propensity toward discrimination, still result in stratification and discrimination by race, ethnicity, religion, nationality, and at this point we should probably consider gender and gender identity, social class, age, and other characteristics on which to discriminate for good or evil. And of course, these traits tend to overlap with each other and are frequently used as proxies for other traits, with discrimination based on one trait sometimes used as the fig leaf to cover or obscure discrimination based on one or more other traits. To take a modern-day example, there can be various valid, even socially acceptable reasons to oppose immigration to one's country from other countries. And some of the current opposition to immigration may indeed be based on legitimate concerns. But in North America and Europe, much of it is rooted in opposition to the other. Indeed, race has been a millstone around the neck of the United States since colonial times. 2 centuries later, during the first century of nationhood, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Herman Melville, wrote passionately and brilliantly about racial issues in the United States, and the country's most destructive war was fought over it. I agree with those who consider racism the Achilles heel of the United States of America throughout our history and extending to the present. As for Europe, in modern times, slavery has not been permitted, but Europeans were the original slave traders between Africa and the Western Hemisphere. Today, on the European continent, some of the world's most modern progressive countries are experiencing considerable unrest over the issue of immigration. Much of it based on a mismatch of nationalism, ethnicity, race, religion, and race, as well as economic fears. In Europe, as in North America and many other places, groups of people who bear visible signs of differences, such as skin color or attire, which can signal religion, social class, or both, seem to draw the most opposition. Researchers have identified racial prejudice among doctors treating patients, corporate managers in hiring, the judicial system in both charging and convicting suspects, legislators in responding to constituents, managers in apartment leasing and automobile renting, professors in selecting research assistants, and music teachers in evaluating student performance. These studies span several decades and are overwhelmingly convincing in their totality. Similar work has been done on gender discrimination and on age. Now, racial and other types of prejudice can have negative consequences on many aspects of people's lives and on society at large. It can directly affect one of the things we try to do in music education, which is teach or at least foster creativity. Researchers at Tel Aviv University in Israel developed tests that estimate the extent of people's essentialist thinking, defined as associating racial differences with abilities and personality traits. They found negative correlations between essentialist thinking and creativity and concluded that the correlations may be causal, that biased thinking may inhibit creativity. The good news is that essentialist thinking can be modified, at least in the short term. The same Israeli researchers had another sample of students read essays that describe race as either a fundamental difference between people, which is an essentialist position, or as a construct that reflected nothing more than skin-deep differences, which is a non-essentialist position. Subjects who read the non-essentialist essay scored 32% higher on a creativity test than did subjects who ran the essentialist essay. The authors concluded that essentialism appears to exert its negative effects on creativity, not through what people think, but through how they think. Now, why is that? Well, it's because, they said, stereotyping and creative stagnation are rooted in a similar tendency to over-rely on existing category attributes. Again, such essentialist thinking may have helped early humans on the savannah, but it can be counterproductive in today's world. Researchers have also devised high-tech tests to measure individuals' reaction to different types of people and situations. The tests measure reaction time in milliseconds to photographs of people of different races in different situations. Some of these tests are now available free of charge on the internet. Like most people in the U.S. who have taken them, I exhibited a slight tendency to favor my own race. I recommend taking one if you haven't done so. These results hold pretty much across the age spectrum, with individuals over 65 of age testing slightly more prejudiced, and those in middle age slightly less prejudiced than people in other age categories. Women tested slightly less prejudiced than men, and holders of PhD degrees exhibited less prejudice than holders of other degrees or no degrees. Holders of MD degrees, physicians, showed the most prejudice of all types of degree holders and non-degree. Other tests, which are not available to the public to my knowledge, measure the propensity of different groups to shoot or not shoot a gun when shown photographs of young men, some black and some white, holding guns in their hands and some holding wallets. This setup is intended to mimic a recent incident in New York when police shot and killed a young black man who was holding a wallet, not a gun, as they thought. On these tests, people tend to make decisions and shoot at black subjects more quickly than white subjects, regardless of the gun versus wallet condition. The researchers attribute this to the evolutionary tendency to distinguish group membership and to project situations involving non-group members as dangerous. In one study, these results held true for officers from the Denver, Colorado Police Department, as well as for general volunteers. However, the police officers were much more accurate than the general volunteers in their discrimination between the gun versus wallet condition. They were also less affected by the race barrier, though they were quicker to shoot regardless of race or the weapon, no weapon condition. Taken together, we have historical and anthropological evidence. We have scientific evidence from experimental studies, and we have our own personal experiences and observations. When we synthesize all this evidence, it appears that the human species is indeed flawed in that everyone is prejudiced against the other. Now, this propensity is not caused by genes, but by our evolutionary history. So what does all this mean for music educators who want to teach world music? I think we should consider the likelihood, based on the various types of evidence, that exposure to world music and some of its contents in educational settings probably helps students become more accepted, less prejudiced, and more empathetic, as well as more knowledgeable about people in racial and ethnic groups other than their own, and let's add different national, religious, age, gender, and gender identity groups. The goal of increased empathy could become increasingly important because despite the obvious progress we've made in some of these areas in many parts of the world, recent events demonstrate a need for a great deal more understanding and tolerance. One worrying contrary trend, if we can believe the research on the topic, is that university students in the current millennial generation are testing about 40% lower in measures of empathy than their counterparts from 20 to 30 years ago. One scholar speculates that this is because social media has replaced face-to-face encounters, that we may be, quote, foregoing the whole body experience of nature for a flat-screen version of it. Findings of reduced empathy are frightening given our need, locally and worldwide, for more understanding. All these different types of evidence and more suggest that world music programs in schools and universities could make a real difference in participants' lives and in society at large. But wait, if we can accept the premise that world music programs could result in such changes, then let's think even bigger and hypothesize that world music could become a driver in the sea change movement toward a significantly more harmonious world community. Does this sound far-fetched? Grandiose? Perhaps. But given that many parts of the world are becoming more diverse, racially and ethnically, and in other ways as well, using all our available tools, music among them is becoming not just something nice to do, but more and more of an imperative. What should world music programs in schools and universities look like? Well, most of you have more experience and insights about this than I, so this morning I'll stick to a few observations and caveats related to music education in American schools, especially high schools. Music classes in these schools are elected by students because there are few, if any, requirements in music. This means that world music, like other music offerings, must compete with all other classes, both music and non-music. It is the great dream of some American music educators to see all secondary school students in standardized music classes, music for general students, in other words. But at only one time in American history did that occur on a widespread basis, and that was in the late 1920s through the 1930s, when required secondary school classes in music appreciation were required. These classes utilize radio broadcasts and sets of commercial recordings produced by phonograph companies. Those general appreciation classes were not popular enough to be sustained, so they disappeared during the World War II period. Meanwhile, elective classes in the form of performing ensembles expanded during the same period, and since have not only survived, but flourished. The curricular model in music in American high schools today is still elective and consists mainly of performing ensembles. Why? Well, it's because kids like universities offer performing ensembles for the same reason, popularity, and to prepare pre-teachers to lead ensembles in the schools. Jazz education entered high schools through the existing band programs, and world music programs will probably need to do something similar. To flourish in this environment, world music will have to appeal to students and accommodate them in large enough classes to render the programs efficient. Combo-sized groups are not efficient in terms of teacher time and space utilization. But the most important factor is popularity. The main reason we have music in secondary schools is the popularity with students, parents, and the public. This may not be true or as true in countries with more centralized education systems and less local control over the curriculum. However, regardless of the power structure, I don't know of a country with substantially widespread music programs in high schools for general students, that is, required of all students. In countries with distributed systems like the U.S. and to a lesser extent Canada, Germany, and Australia, for example, if the music programs in secondary schools were not popular, they would largely disappear. Most university music programs prepare students to work in these popular public school programs. In many universities, music education is the only music major. And even large university music schools with doctoral programs prepare professors to teach in smaller and mid-sized universities, most of which are in the business of preparing teachers. Thus, one could make the case that the edifice of curricular music education in the United States rests on a foundation of popular support for public school music programs. If I could be granted one wish about the music education profession in this country, it would be for leaders and would-be leaders to come to understand popularity as the one essential feature of music education. It is for this reason that hypothetical compulsory general music programs, no matter how well intentioned or how well thought out in terms of philosophy, content, delivery systems, are unlikely to replace popular elective offerings until such time as curriculum is dictated completely by some higher authority. It is astounding to me that the national standards for music education make no mention whatsoever of students enjoying or even appreciating their music classes or activities, not to mention the music itself. This is probably because the proponents sense that learning in the affective domain would not be measurable in what were, even over 20 years ago, the increasingly test-oriented industrialized schools. But so far, the testing movement has largely bypassed music. Now, this is a mixed blessing, but let's double down on doing the things we've always done well, including providing opportunities for kids to enjoy music and music classes, gain skills and knowledge, and grow in ways that research tells us parents value the most, social skills, self-discipline. All this means that to be successful in the public school environment, world music offerings will have to entice students and their parents to elect these classes. Realistically, this probably means offering largely performance-based classes. World music and the ways it is taught can be very enjoyable and can enhance skill, knowledge, and certainly social skills at both the individual and group levels. Already we have enough world music activities in secondary schools and universities to allow us to conduct research studies on the results. Possible areas of research in world music might include experimental studies to determine whether and in which ways subjects exposed to certain kinds of world music would become more accepting of those of respective cultures, or at least less prejudiced against them, much like the prejudice studies mentioned earlier. Different forms of exposure to could be performance experiences and learned information about the respective cultures that produce the musics. After all, if reading a story is effective, certainly performing coupled with reading, discussing, listening, and watching videos about world music, cultures would increase understanding and empathy. Someday, society will get smart and, to the extent possible, let high school and university students learn what they want to learn and how they want to learn. From that point on, ideologies about music and music education notwithstanding, students will elect what they value and want, and when our already popular secondary school music programs will flourish even more. World music programs, based primarily on performance but including other features, can become part of that package of offerings on a widespread basis. I can't think of a better way to bring about genuine, positive mixing among groups and peoples than through exposure to different kinds of music. After all, as we contemplate the potential positive effects of world music instruction and participation, we could recall that music has already done more than its share to bring different groups together. Modern popular music grew out of a synthesis of music produced by different groups in the Appalachian Mountains and cotton-growing regions of the American South, has become arguably the most important music in the world today. Ultimately, it was the juxtaposition of these groups and their musics with both American, European and African roots that grew into the music's worldwide appeal and influence. Major social, economic, and technical forces made modern popular music possible, but they did not, in and of themselves, actually produce it. Instead, it was produced by people from different groups, and it was the juxtaposition of these different cultural groups, especially the different races, that resulted in the creation of these important new styles of popular music. Much popular music arises from the disenfranchised left side of the political spectrum. It was not only a major point of this enhanced contact between the African American and European American peoples in the United States, but it has since also crossed generational and geographical lines. We can work to help world music take its place among other popular music in educational and other settings, keeping in mind that performing, teaching, listening to and studying world music could very well make people more empathetic with each other. Biologist Wilson argues, quote, it is within the power of humanities and the serious creative arts to, within them, to express our existence in ways that began at last to realize the dreams of the Enlightenment, unquote. I think world music can and already does serve as a vehicle for bringing different groups together and closer to each other. By closer, I mean it can facilitate better understanding, empathy, and acceptance while reducing fears about the other. I think we should start promoting world music education programs partly on that basis, bringing research findings to bear on prejudicial behavior and into the public consciousness is a hot topic right now. Much more so than even a year ago when Ray Ching asked me to prepare this address. Interest has really taken off since the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Missouri in August of 2014. And just 2 months ago, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, made comments that seemed to reflect his awareness of recent research on prejudice. Yes, it has been a long wait, but it appears that finally some are using the media to open up about this issue. So I'm betting this is a tipping point. Much like we've had tipping points in the areas of civil rights, women's issues, child abuse, gay and lesbian rights, and others. We should apply the lessons to all forms of prejudice against groups of people and take advantage of the general mood to help secure a place for world music in our schools, universities, and communities. Just last month, I witnessed a large, long-standing community music group in Bursa, Turkey, while they were working with my friend, Professor Suzanne Azek. The players' identity characteristics were highly similar. All were males, ranging in age from 50 to 85 years, and apparently of a single nationality and ethnicity, except, that is, for a violinist and a clarinetist, both highly skilled in the Ottoman-era Turkish classical music style. When I remarked on their ability, Suzanne informed me that they were Roma, gypsies, brought in his ringers to help the group musically. We need more of this. I salute those of you who are working in this wonderful field of world music. You deserve our support. Thank you.
Looking at a human.